This past week, I watched the movie, The 517 to Paris. We rented it, watched it on TV, and I wanted to view the movie from the time that it came out a few years ago. I read all about what had happened, and you probably have done so as well. Some of you may have seen the movie. Three Americans, two servicemen, one civilian, touring Europe, traveling to Paris on a train that left at 5:17, headed for Paris from Holland, I think it was. Somewhere in between the two, a terrorist emerged from one of the restrooms with an AK-47, 9mm pistol. He was confronted immediately by someone who was waiting there at the door, but he pushed past him, although he dropped his rifle. A second man tried to intervene, and he shot him. The scenes from the movie, as I understand it, are very accurate. By the way, many of the actors in the movie, including the three Americans, played themselves in the movie. As the terrorists began to move, I don't know whether it was forward or backward, from car to car, the people, after that one man was shot, began to run in from one train car to the next, and through the doors and open to the next, and so on. And there was a complete panic, and as they would burst into a new car, they would say, "There's a man with a gun, run for your life," and everybody would get up and join the exodus. When they arrived at the car where the three Americans were, there was one of those servicemen, a man by the name of Spencer Stone, professed believer in Jesus Christ. He and his friend were seated together. Stone was closest to the aisle, and he did something remarkable. Instead of joining all of those that were running for their life, he stood up and went in the other direction. He charged straight at the gunman. His fellow servicemen and his friend behind him. The terrorist raised the AK-47, took aim, pulled the trigger, but the hammer fell on a round with a bad primer. The shot never went off, or Spencer Stone would have been dead, and maybe many more. He wrestled the terrorist to the ground, eventually got him in a chokehold. The terrorist reached into his belt or holster, pulled out the 9mm, and put it to Spencer Stone's head, pulled the trigger, but the gun didn't fire. There was no round in the chamber. With the help of his friends, they completely subdued and tied up the terrorist and then assisted the man who had been shot. What a remarkable story. I really like true stories at the movie theater, or wherever they may be. My wife doesn't like them because they don't always have happy endings, but there's something about a true story that has a way more impact. My question to you this morning is this: what made Spencer Stone and his two friends run toward the man with the gun when everybody else was running away? Was it that they had no sense of fear, that fear was totally absent? Hardly. Fear is a natural emotion. It occurs automatically when danger is present. I would even say, and I think you would agree, that it is a blessing of God that He designed us to be fearful. And he designed that in man's creation because otherwise we wouldn't respond at all to threats when we needed, perhaps, to fear the consequences. H. Norman Wright, in his book Crisis and Trauma Counseling, says that in cases of intense stress or traumatic circumstances, that our body, as we react in fear, is flooded with a number of hormones, which induces either a flight or fight response in most people. But what makes the difference? How is it some people, in spite of their fear, can confront the threat and respond effectively, and others cannot or do not? Well, I believe it begins with a mindset. A mindset about fear. A mindset that says that fear is not a reason to give up, and it's not a reason to give in. It just is. And it is a motivation to react, to do what should be done. Now, Israel's situation in Exodus 14 illustrates this point and gives us a great deal of instruction in regard to how we can handle fear. You can't avoid fear, but you've got to learn how to handle your fear. If we can just present a little background here, we're going to begin in chapter 14, verse 1, but if you back up to the previous chapter to verse 20, you'll note that they are in Etham, E-T-H-A-M. Ramses is here. That's the city from which they left on the Exodus. We're through all the land of Goshen. They come down here to Succoth, and then eventually on down to a city right here by the name of Etham. Chapter 13, verse 20. Now here's where it gets interesting. Verse 1 of chapter 14. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel, that they turn and camp before Pihahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal Zephon, and you shall camp before it by the sea." Now let's unravel all of that for a moment. Let's get a little bit of more of a close-up here. They left Ramses, came to Succoth, then they went down to Etham, right here. Now, here's the wilderness. Here's where they needed to go. But the Lord sends them this way. Curiously. But remember, they're being led by the pillar of the cloud by day and the pillar of the fire by night. They're going where the Lord leads them. We talked about the Lord's leadership last week. The thing about this particular maneuver is they placed these bodies of water between them and the wilderness. So now they've got to figure out if they're going to go east, how they're going to cross these bodies of water. Remember, they're somewhere in the neighborhood of probably 2 million people, plus livestock. This is a huge procession of people and possessions. This is not a wise tactical maneuver. It's not a wise way to handle the potential threats. They have no way of escape. Now, again in chapter 14, verse 2, it says, "For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land, the wilderness has closed them in. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them, and I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord." And they did so. Now it was told the king of Egypt, that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people, and they said, "Why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us?" And they made ready his chariot and took his people with him. Also he took 600 choice chariots and all the chariots of Egypt with captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with boldness. Now, even as we noticed in verse 2, Pharaoh, when he is informed of the direction they're taking, says, they're lost, basically. They don't know what they're doing. They're just stumbling around out there. So he senses he has an advantage, and because his heart was already hard, and God continued to harden his heart even more, even after all those 10 plagues, he decided, I'm just going to annihilate these people. They've been enough trouble. So he puts together his best mobile force and pursues them. So this is where we find Israel as we are here in chapter 14. You might note, too, by the way, this picture shows the Red Sea and the Gulf of Suez here, and we're talking about them being way up here, right in this area. The chariot Egyptian force, only mentioned here is 600 chariots, and the illustration is probably not correct. They probably were two men per chariot, a driver and a warrior, perhaps an archer. But this was the most formidable military apparatus on the planet in those days. Even mounted cavalry would have given them a decided advantage militarily. But the chariots is what were used, and they were able to fight from these chariots. Spears, bow and arrow, whatever. This would be like a modern Abrams tank going up against villagers armed with pistols and rifles. And if you could compare that to modern times. So it was a formidable force here. I want you to see the result as we move on now to verse 10. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. The scripture does not say that they were in any danger. The danger was only in their minds, because God was protecting them. Just like he had dealt with Egypt before, he was maneuvering Egypt into a situation where now the military might of Egypt would be destroyed. They could no longer pursue or follow Israel or do them any more damage, and that God would have the complete and final victory over Egypt, Pharaoh, and the so-called gods of Egypt. God had planned this, that he might have the victory and that they might have the victory. But their response is they are frightened to death. Now, we read earlier they had 600,000 men alone of the Israelites. Even if only half of them were of fighting age, that's 300,000 men against 1,200 charioteers. Could they not have defended themselves, even without training, even without the best of weapons, could they have defended themselves 300,000 or more against 1,200? Were they really in that much danger? Now, granted, that particular force could have done a lot of damage very quickly, perhaps even secured the victory, but it would have taken the role of fear in the hearts of the Israelites for that to happen. And that has taken place. I'm here to you this morning to help us see here in this chapter and in this situation and in these circumstances how it was they overcame their fear, and how we also can deal with fear in our own lives. So the point I want to make this morning is a very simple one. Don't let fear defeat you. Fear is oftentimes the thing that defeats us, that deprives us of success or blessing, and not the circumstances that produce the fear. So how is it that we can overcome fear? How is it that we can prevent our fear from defeating us? Well, there's two realizations we need to make in our heart and mind. Fear can only be addressed logically. Fear is an emotion. If we allow our emotions to dictate our actions, we'll do the wrong thing most all the time. But we must use our minds, we must use truth, and we must use that to handle, deal with our fear, and make decisions, and make or take actions that are appropriate in spite of the fear we may be feeling. So what are these two realizations? Well, number one, we need to admit and understand that fear is an obstacle. But it is not an epitaph. You see, to the children of Israel, they thought, we're done. We're toast. We're dead. To them, they were fearful because fear was indicating we have no hope. We're out of hope. That's not what fear indicates. Fear indicates there is a threat. Fear indicates there is a danger. But fear does not remove hope. Fear is sometimes an unexpected experience, and it is oftentimes a very stubborn obstacle. Notice here, the children of Israel, they're getting along good at this point. They've spoiled the Egyptians. They're making headway. They're following the pillar of the cloud. God's leading them, and then suddenly, everything changes. Suddenly, they're thrown into a traumatic situation. So fear rears its ugly head. They are too frightened to act logically, to deal with the threat themselves. They didn't really even need to deal with it themselves if they would just trust in God. God had done all the fighting for them up till now. He wasn't going to cease doing that. But their fear got the best of them. It didn't have to. Fear can be a stubborn obstacle, but it is not one that cannot be overcome. Fear has an incapacitating effect, unfortunately. If we allow it to, it will completely incapacitate us from doing or prevent us from doing the things we should be doing or from responding in the way we should respond. So let's look at that for a few minutes now. Fear's incapacitating effects. Number one, I want you to back up, if you will, to verse 8. Remember, everything earlier in chapter 14, God is speaking to Moses and telling Moses what's going to happen. No strong evidence here that he told everybody else. But I want you to notice in verse 8 their level of confidence. And the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel. Now, there's a semicolon there, and I interpret this to mean that they weren't aware that Pharaoh was after them yet. In contrast to what's about to happen, we note this statement at the end of verse 8. And the children of Israel went out with boldness. The King James Version says with a high hand. It means they went out with confidence. boldness. They were upbeat. They were ready to go. They were excited. They thought, we're home free. Nothing's going to stop us now. They had that kind of attitude. But oh, how quickly it changes. Oh, how quickly the confidence is eroded. In verse 10, we read how they became very afraid when they saw the chariots approaching. Fear replaced their confidence. Fear removed their bravado. Fear erodes confidence. Fear always does that if you allow it to do it. Fear will take away your confidence. And when you take away confidence here, it's the equivalent for us as Christians in this day and age to understand that fear and faith do not exist together if fear is not controlled. Uncontrolled fear you give into, fear you give up because of, that kind of fear cannot and does not exist alongside of faith. Faith sees beyond the circumstances. Faith looks to God. We must not allow our fear to erode our confidence. Let's go back to verse 10. The latter statement in verse 10. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to God. Now, when you first read that, you may think, well, that's a logical thing to have. They're looking to God for help. This wasn't a confident prayer. This was a desperate cry. The Hebrew here indicates it was a cry of distress. The Hebrew words mean that they were crying out for help. My little 2.5-year grandson, he has this thing where if things aren't going his way and something's not right, he goes, help! Now that's fine at home. There's been a few times in public where something went kind of haywire and he's going, help! Help! And I'm looking around thinking, am I going to be arrested? Or is his parents going to be arrested? And so it was a desperate cry to God. And in that sense, it was a complaint, if you will. Fear erodes confidence and removes faith. It also elicits complaint. Sometimes in the midst of fear, our prayers are not prayers of faith, but they are prayers of complaint. God, can't believe you let this happen to me. Lord, what are you doing? Are you on vacation or something? What, don't you know what's going on here? Fear always produces complaint. But that's not all. Let's continue. Verse 11. Then they said to Moses. They already complained to God. Now they turned to the leadership. Then they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Now that's a pretty ironic statement, because Egypt was all about graves. Remember they built those big pyramids to put all the dead pharaohs in? There was a huge amount of land dedicated for burial purposes in Egypt. There were plenty of places set aside to bury people in Egypt. You know, they bombed people and did all that stuff. We've all read about it. So the people say, hey, have you brought us out here to die in these wide open spaces because there wasn't enough place to bury us back in Egypt? Well, that's a real tender statement to make to your to your commander-in-chief, right? Verse 12. Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than we should die in the wilderness? Not only, Moses, have you put us in a horrible position, but it's your fault we're here! Their confidence eroded. Their faith evaporated. They begin to complain to God and then they turn on their leadership. Fear erodes confidence. elicits complaint and engenders criticism. A word to the wise, if some of you that serve in leadership positions, be it in the workplace or the church or wherever it may be, oftentimes criticism that comes your way is induced or caused by fear and a lack of faith. So this is what fear does. It's a clear picture of what fear does in an organization, a group, an army, the church, whatever the group may be. The fear doesn't need to be fear of your life. It might be something that's much less intense or traumatic. Sometimes it's just a fear of change. Sometimes it's a fear that things won't be the same as they always have been. Sometimes the fear is monetary, material. I may lose something. May not be as well off if I do this or make this decision. Sometimes the fear is nobody will support me if I step out on faith. Sometimes the fear is nobody will accept me if I take that position. The fears can be multifaceted and they run the gamut in life. Listen, fear is a normal part of life. I will be the first to admit to you that I am fearful of many things. Who in their right mind wouldn't be looking around in this world? You can be afraid of what's going to happen. You can be afraid of everything from volcanoes and like they have in Hawaii to nuclear war to electromagnetic pulse. Yeah, you can come up. There are so many things to be afraid of in this world. Terrorists, evil people. Then there's the health concerns and diseases, and there's issues and issues, and there's plenty of things to be afraid of. But we as Christians must not, we cannot, we should not ever allow fear to dictate our choices and dictate our actions or absence of action. So, yes, fear is an obstacle, but it's not an epitaph. And secondly, and here's realization number two. If we're going to be able to overcome our fear, we've got to realize fear, yeah, it's an obstacle, but it's not an end. It's not the end and without, it's not something that's brought about a situation with no hope. Not at all. But then number two, we have to realize that fear can be effectively overcome. Oh, it may not be easy. In fact, it's just plain not easy. But fear can be overcome. The question is, how do we do that? How do we overcome our fear? What can we learn here in this situation? We'll take it up at verse 13. And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid." Now, by that command that he gives to the people, there is the indication here given that God expects us to be able to handle our fears. When Moses says, "Don't be afraid," what he is saying is don't be overwhelmed by your fear. Don't let fear determine what you do. Don't let fear determine how you think. And he doesn't just give them a broad statement, "Don't be afraid." He adds the particulars. He gives them the how. So he says, "Don't be afraid. And by the way, here's how you cannot be afraid. Here's how you can overcome fear." It's right here in our text. And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." And the Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward." Now let's analyze that. Here are the steps to overcoming fear. The first one is this. Stand still. Stay where you're at. The New King James says, stand still. The Hebrew indicates standing your ground. Standing firm where you're at. Now, why was that important in this circumstance? Well, if they didn't stay where they were at, and they didn't stay together, they wouldn't have been ready to cross the Red Sea when it parted. Because if they would have fled in panic, they would not have ran into the sea. They would have ran north and south along the shore. And being scattered and being weakened by that thinning out process, the Egyptian chariots could have divided and conquered all day long, having more mobility, more experience, and more weaponry. In that state of panic, it would have been a horrible situation. So Moses says, stand your ground. Stay where you're at. By the way, the overwhelming number one command we find in the New Testament in regard to temptation and Satan's onslaught is always what? Resist. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. Don't flee from the devil. Now we understand there's circumstances where it's best you flee from those circumstances to avoid temptation. But we're not talking about circumstances. James says flee only, James says resist the devil. Don't flee from him. You flee maybe from a circumstance he's orchestrated, but resist the devil. Resist. We find that several times in the New Testament. You've got to stand your ground. You've got to put up a fight. You can't let fear cause you to succumb, give in, give up, run away. There's nowhere to run. So he says, stand still. Then number two, he says, keep your eyes on God. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. That's a pretty strong statement. And the Lord will fight for you. He didn't ask him to pick up a sword. He didn't ask him to put up any defensive lines. He didn't ask him to dig any foxholes. He didn't ask the men to step out front and put the women and children back. He just said, stand still and watch what's going to happen. Stand still and watch. Interestingly, in verse 16, God tells Moses, lift up the rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. Remember the rod? Go back to chapter 14. When the first God said to Moses, what's that in your hand? It was the shepherd's staff, the rod. He threw it down, it became a snake. He picked it up, it became a rod again. That was the symbol of God's power and presence and his miraculous ability to deal with the needs of the nation. He said, by the way, Moses, hold up the rod along with your hand. I want the people to see it. I want them to understand who it is doing what's going to happen. It talks about an east wind and all that, but there's no natural cause here. God opened up the water. And he may have used the wind in some degree to dry the surface and to have play a part in it. But it wasn't a natural wind. It wasn't something that, those who disbelieve the Word of God, and we'll probably talk about this more next week, those who want to come up with natural explanations for biblical miracles are just doing so because they don't want to believe. This was a miraculous occurrence that God was about to bring to bear on a situation. Keep your eyes on God. By the way, God came through for Spencer Stone too, twice. The AK-47 didn't fire and 9mm didn't fire. Amazing. What's the odds of that? It's astronomical. No. There are no odds. Because God was on the scene. See? Same way here. Okay, so stand firm and just keep your eye on God. Trust God. This is equivalent to you put your faith in the Lord. You've seen what He's done before. Don't forget. Remember the rod. Remember God. He's going to fight for you. And number three, be quiet. I love this one. Stand still. Keep your eye on God and shut up. Isn't that what he's saying? Verse 14, and the Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. What do we do with, what's the picture of someone frightened? What's the cartoon picture of someone scared? They're running at full speed away from the threat, screaming, ah! And God says, don't give in to your natural inclinations. Stay where you're at, stand still, don't run away, and shut up! And watch! Pretty simple. Pretty simple. Now, when you're full of emotion, and fear's got its grip around your throat with both hands, you know, it's not easy to not run away. It's not easy to put it in God's hands. But it can be done. And by the way, when you learn to do this, and when you begin to do this in the little matters, in the little frightening things in life, you'll grow stronger and you'll be able to apply it in the most traumatic of circumstances. And the be quiet covers this matter of complaint and criticism too. The inclination is, things are going wrong and I'm uncomfortable and I don't like what's happening. I'm going to complain and I'm going to criticize and I'm going to blame somebody else and I'm going to see if I can get some action from somewhere to rectify the situation, take away the fear and remove the problem. God says, be quiet. Stand still. Let me work. Be quiet. You see, fear is contagious. One person begins to scream out in fear, the tendency is for the person next to them to do the same, and the next, and the next. When complaint and criticism begins to rumble and roll, it's like a big snowball rolling down the hill. Fear is contagious. Fear is disruptive. Fear brings defeat. Fear produces a lack of hope. For crying out loud when you're afraid, do what you do when you have a cold and you cough. Cover your mouth. Just shut up. Don't spread the contagion. If you're scared to death, just don't act like it. Just listen. Don't let on. Just be cool. You'll be amazing how that becomes contagion. Remember what happened when Gideon had too many soldiers? The first thing God said to him, by the way, they were already outmanned 6-1 or something like that when God told him, by the way, Gideon, before you go confront the Midianites, here's what I want you to do. Tell everybody that's afraid to go home. Everybody's afraid. Just get on out of here. We don't need you. Why do you suppose God did that? There wasn't going to be any fear contagion running around the camp that way, was there? At the very least. And then finally, to overcome fear, you've got to take the appropriate action. Simple as that. Now, the appropriate action here was to follow God's leadership. Let Him deal with the problem, but you be ready to move. You be ready to follow. But lift up your rod, verse 16, and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, and the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. They couldn't have went where they were supposed to go if they'd been scattered and running around, scared to death, trying to get out of there. Screaming at the top of their voice, they couldn't have taken instruction, they couldn't have heard anything, they couldn't have reacted as a group, they couldn't have stayed together, they couldn't have crossed the sea. But when we stand firm and when we look to God and when we are quiet and waiting and we're faithful, God will show you the way and the response and the action that you need to take. The sea will part, but you've got to go through the divided water. It might be scary on the other side. Might not be to my liking on the other side. That's okay. Because God's leading you.